to the sixth episode of the MisesUK.org podcast, as sponsored by finlingo.com. My name's Andy Duncan, and tonight, once again, I'm coming to you from a cold, dark, and very rainy Henley-on-Thames on Monday, the 22nd of January. Tonight, on the glorious day when the US federal government has apparently shut down, I'm speaking with Jeff Deist, the president of the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. We're going to be speaking about that phenomenon of our age, President Donald Trump. So, without further ado, good evening, Jeffrey.
Hello, Andy. Apparently, our betters in Washington, D.C. managed to hammer out a compromise today. Against all odds will enable us to work under the federal rubric once again. So have no fears, England. You're in good hands.
we're safe. What would we have done if all those people in the U.S. federal government had stopped working today? Well, at least I can sleep safe in my bed tonight. Now, last week we chatted on Skype for a few minutes, and you said Alabama was very cold, which I couldn't believe because I nearly died of heat stroke when I went there once. So how's it going down there today?
Well, it's true. The U.S. South and cold are not two things that most people normally associate. But yesterday, I'm happy to say, Sunday was a beautiful 70-degree cloudless sky day. So we're back to our normal winter. So for that, I'm happy. Summer is a bit different question. But you're an Englishman, so you undoubtedly suffer when you come here.
Yeah, well, as long as I have plenty of gin and tonic, I'm generally okay. Now, President Donald Trump's been in the White House now for just over 1 year. And even with this federal shutdown, which didn't happen, unfortunately, the sky still managed to stay up. It hasn't fallen in yet. How can you explain this?
It really is interesting how most of the criticisms aimed at Trump by progressives are based on tone and style rather than substance. There was a march yesterday in the U.S. in many, many cities, but primarily in Washington, D.C., which was exactly 1 year after the first march that happened, a woman's march, not long after Trump was inaugurated in 2017. And I saw a sign yesterday from the march in Washington on a photo, which really struck me. It said, it was a woman holding a sign that said, "If Hillary was president, we'd all be at brunch." And I thought that was just so telling because, as we all know, Hillary, her tendencies would be to escalate or even increase the number of conflicts the United States is involved in. And her tendencies would be to escalate and increase the number of domestic depredations the U.S. FedGov is involved in. So it really shows you that this is not about policy or substance. This is about a really visceral hatred of Trump, some of which he brings upon himself. But it really is an irrational period, not only in the United States and in the West. And in that sense, it's a little frightening.
Yeah, we're getting all these kinds of value statements in the UK as well, where the government says we're going to ban all petrol cars within 20 years, knowing full well that in 20 years' time, things will happen that will happen then. Now, a lot of my US-based friends, and we won't mention any names, love President Trump. As Austrians, though, should we be careful supporting any political leader?
Well, he doesn't seem to have an intellectual bone in his body. I don't know what he's read. I suspect very little. And there's something to be said for a non-ideologue as president. What we have to be particularly careful of is the people who are convinced of their own rightness and their own goodness. The do-gooders of the world, let's say an Al Gore, in many ways frighten me more than a Trump. The frightening thing about Trump is his ego and his thin skin. His need to lash out at critics, I don't care about a lack of decorum, because the decorum in government seems sort of silly to those of us who are anti-government. But it's not about decorum. It's more about temperament and instinct. Someone who could unleash U.S. military forces or U.S. military might, sort of lurching about in the White House and easily angered and not really listening to advisors. From everything I've read, his attention span in meetings is very, very limited. And so you have to grab him and make a point early. But then if someone comes and has a meeting with him after you and they grab him better than you did, he'll just lurch and change his mind. So he's definitely a volatile human that probably served him well amongst all the sharp elbows undoubtedly being thrown in the Manhattan real estate market. But as president, it's a different beast. But I don't know libertarians who love him per se. I know libertarians who love things about him or what he represents. And So I'm not exactly sure that we should love him, but we do know what Hillary is and what Hillary would have been. That's the thing, is Hillary and her husband are known quantities, and Trump was not. That's what's so astonishing about the whole thing.
Now, when he first came in, lots of his policies were very what you might call blue collar, and I don't profess to know too much about American politics, but very Democrat in a way. And he used to raise funds for Hillary and for Bill Clinton and various others, and he had various protectionist policies on board. But in the last year, he does seem to have put in a lot of conservative policies. And one I particularly like is pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. Has he actually done some Austrian things in the last year or some conservative things?
Well, it's interesting. He did speak with John Allison, who was the former head of Cato and who was a longtime banker with BB&T, who is a hardcore anti-Fed guy. He spoke with him and met with him prior to nominating Powell as a successor to Janet Yellen as head of the Fed. He's also appointed some Austrian-leaning people in the Department of Education and elsewhere. So I don't think that he has a doctrine or an ideology that motivates him at all, but he does sometimes seem to stumble upon a truffle underneath all the acorns. So I don't know. It's just impossible to know. The only person that we at the Mises Institute know who actually know him somewhat on a personal level is Judge Andrew Napolitano, who has just known him in New York City over the years. The judge happens to live in Trump Tower, so he's a tenant of Trump's in that sense. Mm-hmm. And so we've been able to get a little bit of Trump the man from him. But if he's done some Austrian things, Andy, it's inadvertent. Let's just leave it that way.
Well, should we talk about then his tax cuts? Because in the last couple of months, the left hate his tax cuts, which to me, whenever the left hate anything, I tend to like it. What do you think of his corporate and personal tax cuts? Are they useful for growing an economy at all, or are they just ephemeral?
I think they're mildly useful. They're more useful in the sense that they give people hope that when the government takes in a little bit less revenue, or even if it takes in more but cuts rates a little bit, the sky doesn't fall, and we aren't all hanging on every last penny in the federal budget to keep us fed and clothed and housed. And I think as a business guy who paid a lot of taxes and saw a lot of really lengthy corporate tax returns during his business career, he understands that. He also understands how low interest rates help business guys at the expense of the little guy, little old ladies trying to save in their passbook account without getting into exotic investments and that sort of thing. So he's mentioned that a couple of times, how he seems to understand that a low interest rate environment is artificially good for real estate, but perhaps not the common guy. So yeah, the tax cuts are good and they're healthy. And what's so interesting to me is how Apple has now pledged to repatriate a lot of foreign earnings that had been building up in its subsidiary companies overseas. And they're going to bring these back into the U.S., many, many, many hundreds of millions of dollars at a special one-time low tax rate on those repatriated earnings. They'll be paid up from a subsidiary foreign corporation to the parent Apple Corporation in the form of a dividend. So that appeals to his America jobs first type rhetoric and the people who employ that, the people who believe in that sort of thing. So it's a mixed bag, but the tax cut thing is something that's blunted a lot of the conservative criticism of Trump, people who don't like his tone and style and think he's an irreligious man and that sort of thing. So it was certainly brilliant politically that he got it through. But I think the benefits are small, but still good.
In the last few weeks as well, we've also heard a lot about his 1 year in the economy, and the numbers all seem very, very good in the economy, high kind of stock exchange figures and so on. But speaking about money printing, are these numbers high because the economy has actually grown, or is it just because there's more money being printed so the numbers look better?
There's certainly more base money has been created since the crash of 2008 than any other time in history. The problem is, or the question is, whether that money is mostly just sitting around in the form of bank reserves for commercial banks who aren't really lending it. Surely it's a double-edged sword, because I think Trump is treading on very dangerous ground when he trumpets about the stock market, because first of all, Americans have unreasonably short attention spans, and they oftentimes have imbecilic views of what drives an economy and what drives a stock market. So all of the things that have been building up towards highs in the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange were set into motion many, 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 many years before Trump ever even thought about running for office. So just as presidents aren't really responsible for recessions and depressions that may happen to occur during their terms, they're also not responsible for what I would say in this case is an ersatz form of economic prosperity. I think it's very silly and dangerous for him to talk about this, because if the economy turns, then he'll be in very rough shape heading into 2020, because he'll be forced to accept the good with the bad.
Yeah, maybe he's just one of Napoleon's lucky generals. Do you think he will run again? Because I thought he'd only do one term just for fun. Do you think he'll do a second term or go for a second term?
It would be a stroke of genius if he didn't. And Trump being Trump, he wouldn't let the other side, or his supposedly his own side, know that, I'm sure, until very late in the game. So I think it would be wise. It would take away progressives' opportunity to visit retribution upon his head, which is what's going to motivate the 2018 and 2020 elections, no question. And it would also, if he had that in the back of his mind now, this far out, it would free him up to do more of what he'd really like to do. So it'd be politically a masterstroke, but I suspect his ego is such that he will run again. There's something about being president that make people want to run again. So I think you should tell him that, Andy. I think you should suggest that to him.
Speaking of imbecility, one of my favorite movies is Idiocracy. And the U.S. president in that is President Camacho, who you might have seen on YouTube. Now, we do hear rumors that Oprah Winfrey is going to be running for the Democrats and possibly against Donald Trump, another TV star. Do you think with these TV stars, starting, of course, with Ronald Reagan, becoming U.S. presidents, are we beginning to see a move towards the world of idiocracy?
Well, it's idiocracy versus technocracy, I suppose, when we look at leaders in Europe like Juncker and Merkel, and who are really technocrats in a certain sense. We've got idiocrats over here. And I think Oprah Winfrey would be a formidable candidate, because first and foremost, the name ID question is done away with up front. She has a lot of money and she has a lot of fans. And I do think that the Democrats will not have a white male as their standard bearer in 2020. There's no question in my mind that the next Democratic candidate will be a woman,
yeah,
and in Oprah's case, it would be a black woman. So I think she has as good a chance as any. But here's what's so strange about the whole thing is that I guarantee you Oprah and Donald Trump would agree on just about everything deep down in their heart of hearts. And I also, when I look at the left and I think about the years that they enjoyed under Obama, and they really did like him, they view what I would consider his aloofness, they consider some indication of high intelligence. I question that. I think he was aloof because he was out of his league. And I think he was an empty suit. And I think he was pushed through the Ivy League. And I don't think there's any there. But he did a good job of hiding it, almost like Peter Sellers in Being There. But nonetheless, if you had told Democrats a few years ago, people on the left in America, and said, look, after Obama's eight years, we're going to have a Republican president. But here's the good news. It's not going to be some right-wing governor from some deep red state in the South. It's going to be some guy who's not animated by social issues, who doesn't really care about abortion, who's lived and worked his entire life in the New York real estate milieu, who's very comfortable with gay and lesbian folks, having worked with many of them over the years, who's very comfortable with Jewish folks, having worked with many of them over the years, who's actually pro-labor union and pro-protectionist. And that's the Republican president you're going to have to suffer through, not some Mike Huckabee or Ted Cruz. I think most Democrats would have been delighted with that prospect. But since the name of that person happens to be Donald Trump, and since he is who he is on a personality level, they've gone apoplectic. So it's bizarre. If I weren't an American, I would enjoy it.
It is fun to watch, I must say. Now, one of the things he said he was going to do was he was going to drain the swamp of all these people who hate him so much in the American establishment. Was that just election rhetoric, or is he actually draining the swamp? Is he actually harming them in the long run?
Well, he's upset them because he came out of nowhere and he pulled the football away at the last minute. So there's no question in my mind that he's not a deep state plant or some planned thing, but rather he really just did take them by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even like the term deep state because it's not deep. When we say deep state, what we really mean is just the administrative agencies. That's when we talk about the government in America, that's what the government is. It's all the various departments and bureaus and agencies that reside under the president. Who's on the Supreme Court scarcely matters. Who's in Congress scarcely matters. And to an extent, even who is president scarcely matters. It's the 95% of those administrative agencies and departments who do not come and go with the current president, who have deep union protections, who have very good pensions, who have every reason to stay there. We call them lifers. It's those people who really run America. They're unelected, and there's nothing deep about them. You can go look them up. But here's the thing. When somebody in the administrative agencies acts against you, let's say the EPA comes onto your land and demands something, or the IRS sues you, or the SEC accuses you of insider trading, Andy, for 99% of Americans, they have to just roll over and perhaps enter some sort of agreement. Most people do not have the means to spend 10 years and $1 million on lawyer fees to fight what is, in fact, the real government. And all of those agencies have lawyers, plus they have the Department of Justice. All of those lawyers are already on the payroll and have all day long to create billable hours for your lawyer defending you. So for most people, when you say the federal government comes along and does X and your recourse is to sue the federal government in its own courts, well, that's an illusory remedy for most. And so even Trump can't overcome that. He can't drain that swamp. And that's really what threatens us.
Yeah, he's also got into hot water as well with stories recently with a lady called Stormy Daniels. Who's been allegedly doing various things to his body with Forbes magazine. So maybe he does do a little bit of reading. But nothing seems to stick with him. Is he the new, if not even Forbes magazine, is he the new Teflon president?
Well, I guess that's what's so interesting about Trump is you change the narrative. And he's certainly done that. Look, his major outrages eclipse his minor ones, let's just say. And we don't really know what's true about the story with this pornographic actress. But I think that what's been identified among conservatives, especially Christian conservatives, as their hypocrisy on supporting Trump, who's clearly not a guy who cares or who is motivated by Christian faith. There's no question he is not that. So why do they stand up for him and are they gross hypocrites? Well, the best explanation I could find just prior to the election was they were looking for a bodyguard. They view the left as deeply hostile to all things Christian. And so that explains some of his Teflon effect among conservatives. But I think he also has the ability to constantly change the story. Something that is a huge story for 48 hours, like the Las Vegas shooting, is just immediately swept away by the latest Trump thing. I remember when he went after a talk show host named Mika Brzezinski, who co-hosts with this awful former congressman, you know, talked about her facelift. And that was just the huge story for 24 hours. How could he say that? And then just the next day, there was something new. There's something new. There's something new. So there's this form of outrage fatigue. And just as the left is getting its sea legs and saying, oh, my gosh, how can all of you supposedly moral Republicans support this guy who paid off a porn star to keep quiet? There's quicksand under their feet. We're already on to the next thing. So I think that's how he does it.
I'm almost outraged that he paid her off, but she spoke up anyway, even though she'd got his money, which I think is pretty bad, allegedly, of course. Now, speaking about this outrage from the left towards Trump, I'm a big secessionist, and I'd always hoped that New Hampshire or Texas or Alaska would secede from the United States. Do you think there's any chance of somewhere like California or Oregon or maybe even New York State seceding from the United States to get away from Trump, especially if he wins the next election and then maybe somebody like him wins the election after that?
Boy, if he wins in 2020, that is really going to heat up. For now, our friends on the left have rediscovered federalism and states' rights, which is interesting. They're talking about sanctuary cities and ignoring federal edicts and punishing police who cooperate with federal immigration agents during sweeps that are allegedly going to begin occurring in California, this sort of thing. So I enjoy that. I do like the idea that our friends on the left have finally woken up to the idea that elections do not necessarily confer legitimacy on politicians or the government that they run. So I'm all for this awakening. But secession in the United States will forever and ever be associated, unfortunately, with the Civil War and with the Confederacy and with slavery. And I think that fact has poured concrete between the ears of a lot of people. Look, 320 million people with widely diverse interests can't be governed competently by Washington. There's no question that we should be many nations in America. And if Trump wins, I think that's actually possible. I think the left assumed that progressivism and globalism were just inevitable, that that was the arc of history and that was continuing apace, and that Hillary would win and that we would become more and more like Europe. And these terrible deplorables, especially older white deplorables, would simply die. And that's true. I still think that's true. And I still think that's happening. But I think it's happening slower than they hoped. And we've seen this with Brexit as well. There were a lot more old country English folks voting on Brexit than they imagined. So the question we have to ask to our progressive friends, and I say this in good faith and with certain progressive friends I have whom I love, you know, would you be willing to have almost all the things you want here and now in certain smaller geographies in exchange for some sort of federalism or secession? Or do you insist on ruling everywhere, but eventually? That really is the question. And I think because they saw all this stuff as inevitable, they said, well, look, the only reason you right-wingers or you libertarians are talking about secession and centralization is because you're losing. But now that they've had a taste of losing, all of a sudden, it doesn't seem so crazy anymore. So that would be a wild, wild thing to consider if Trump wins in 2020.
Yes, it'd be interesting if California or maybe just San Francisco pulled out of the United States. That would be incredible. It's one of the things I like about Trump is that he has pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, which the left hated. He's been against the UN and so on. So if he did stand then, just on that basis of putting a broom up the backs of the left, would you vote for him in 2020?
No, I wouldn't vote for him because I'm too namby-pamby on. I don't want to vote for someone who's going to drop bombs on anyone and then feel like I have that on me. But the thing about Trump is if San Francisco tried to secede, he would thwart it. He wouldn't see the wisdom in letting them go. That's what I fear about him. So I don't think there's anything that could happen in between now and 2020 that would make me vote for Trump. But I'm not a voting kind of guy. I don't know what else to say about it, but I can certainly cheer his good bits from the sidelines.
And what do you think the next 3 years are going to be like with him?
Well, I know what it's not going to be like, and that is that there's this narrative amongst libertarians because the libertarian moment has faded. Let's face it. There was a peak there in the 2008 to 2012 timeframe with Ron Paul running twice and then with his son Rand developing some momentum and potentially being the Republican nominee, although that fizzled badly, where we felt we had a libertarian moment happening in the U.S. And then Trump came along and sucked all the oxygen out of the room. And we ought not lie to ourselves about that. That's just the facts. And so we're in a period of time where we have to regroup. So I've heard people say there's so much disgust, Andy, with the two major parties in the U.S. that 2018 and 2020 are going to be about the rise of third parties. And I think this is absolute nonsense. I think 2018 and 2020 are going to be about, first and foremost, female candidates.
Yep.
I think both parties are going to promote as many female candidates as possible. And I think the progressive narrative is going to be about revenge against Trump. Hurt this man, hurt the people who voted for him, because they had the audacity to push back against our inevitability narrative. So that's going to be the theme. That's going to be the overriding topic, and that argument is going to be fought within the framework of the two parties. And any third party that threatens to take a few votes or a few percentage points away from either Republicans or the Democrats is going to be savaged by one of those two parties, respectively, because they're going to say, "Look, all of you people who voted for Jill Stein, you cost Hillary the election, and we ended up with Trump. So put aside this third party nonsense and just, you know, vote for the actual candidate who has a chance. That's what I think is going to be the narrative, revenge on Trump. And it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be fun. And I don't look forward to the 2018 midterm elections, because it, try as I might, it'll clog up my life, at least via social media, for months.
Yeah, the wonder of democracy. Anyone can be a leader as long as you work for one of the two parties. Well, it's been great talking to you again tonight, Jeff. Before we go, is there anything else you think our listeners need to know about the Mises Institute?
Well, if you find yourselves in the United States, please come visit us. We're very near the Atlanta airport. Please visit Mises.org. You will find an absolute lifetime worth of reading there if you're interested in economics, or if you're interested in political economy or libertarian political theory in general. There's no shortage of free content there, and we would love, absolutely love, to have you on our site. We'd love to have you following us on social media, and we'd love to hear from you and have you engaged with us.
Well, I can just say to people, try to avoid going in July or August when I went. When I nearly died being an Englishman. Anyway, thank you very much for your time tonight, Jeff Deist.
Thank you, Andy.
We hope you enjoyed tonight's programme on the MisesUK.org podcast. If you'd like to help us out, we'd really appreciate any 5-star ratings and reviews you can give us on iTunes, or if you can share our links on your favourite social media site. It really does help us to spread the message of Austrian economics around. You can also help us out by going to our donate page at MisesUK.org and making a contribution. We're very excited here at Mises UK because this weekend is our first ever conference in London, in which our guest of honour will be Professor Hans Hermann Hoppe. And this is mostly being paid for through those donations. So thank you to anyone who's helped us out financially in the last year to pay for this conference. We'll be back soon after the conference with our 7th episode of the MisesUK.org podcast. In the meantime, please look after your property and freedom responsibly.